KALW.
You can get a cardiac arrest, you can get heat exhaustion.
Summer vacation is in full swing. Today we're going to hear what it's like being a medic at a favorite summer destination, Great America.
Med 1, control, respond on reports of a 10-5-3 at the 2-2 line from it.
So 10-5-3 is a person down, so it could be anyone who like fainted or passed out. We've even gotten called for someone sleeping on a bench.
Part of our series, At Work. Then we speak with author Judy Juanita about joining the Black Panther Party in the 60s.
Until that weekend of Martin Luther King and Lil Bobby Hutton being killed, it was just extraordinarily exciting.
And we'll hear readings from three San Francisco authors, Beth Weingartner, Virgie Tovar, and Jody Klein. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. California's Great America in Santa Clara is a popular family destination, famous for its rides, and it even appears in a few Hollywood cameos in movies like Beverly Hills Cop 3. But last week, the land that's home to the amusement park was sold, which means the park will eventually close. Don't worry, though, there is still time to get your adrenaline rush on a roller coaster because the owners who sold the property said the park could remain open for up to 11 more years. And even though that's more than a decade away, it isn't the first time Great America has closed. COVID-19 closed the park for most of 2020. And when it reopened, some things had changed, especially when it came to their staff. From our archives and the series At Work, Christopher Beale brings us a story about someone on the park's safety team whose experiences during the pandemic changed her perspective on work.
Med 1, control, respond on reports of a 10-5-3 at the 2-2 line from it.
So 10-5-3 is a person down, so it could be anyone who like fainted or passed out or just got a little dizzy.
I'm on the job with Safety Operations Supervisor Elena Duffield. She's an EMT and a native of Santa Clara County.
We've even gotten called for someone sleeping on a bench. Yeah.
It just means person that is non-vertical.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly, yes.
The safety team responds to any medical emergency in the park, big or small.
So two different rides are calling this in. And then they're also reporting a lost child along with it.
They also work together with security to keep the park safe. Things like making sure gates into dangerous areas are locked and that safety equipment is functioning properly.
I'm noticing that even at, you know, noon on a Friday, I would say a majority of the demographic is either families or teenagers.
No, for sure.
Does that ring true most of the time here?
Most of the time, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
What is it about the teenagers? Why is it?
It's the cheap babysitter.
Okay.
Parents buy their kids season passes and they go have fun. And the parents go to work.
And then the folks in safety and security take care of their kids,
yep,
for the night.
Pretty much.
Elena began her career as an EMT 8 years ago and then came to Great America a couple of years later.
I was working on a transport ambulance, and so it just felt like the same thing every shift, every day, same paperwork every day. Where here, it's you don't know what you're going to get. You can get a cardiac arrest, you can get a stroke, you can get plenty of boo-boos and band-aids and stuff like that. You can get heat exhaustion.
Talk about a day on the job that you'll never forget.
On one of our coasters, we ended up having a unresponsive guest who was on the coaster with no pulses. So we ended up having to do CPR after pulling him off one of our roller coasters. And so that was a pretty big thing here.
Whatever happened with that guy?
We got pulses back. They ended up finding out he had a underlying heart condition and fixed it.
At the beginning of 2020, teams at California's Great America were preparing for their March through December operating year, but preparing the park to operate during the pandemic, adding social distancing markers to the queues and plexiglass barricades and putting hand sanitizer stands all over the park. And then one day,
our HR department sent an email out to all associates.
In the midst of all that prep work, Elena and many of her coworkers were furloughed.
That was our last day of work.
There was hope in those days that the pandemic would end quickly. Of course, it did not, and by August, it became clear that Great America would not open for the 2020 season. So Elena shifted focus to being a full-time parent to her son.
Emerson?
cumbersome.
He's 3 and a half.
She says that she felt bad having to coop him up in the house, though.
He doesn't understand why we can't go anywhere, why we can't go to the park, why we can't go over to the beach and stuff. And so we added a lot more, like, climbing stuff to our backyard. We pretty much turned our backyard into a park since we weren't able to take him anywhere.
About 2 weeks into being furloughed, Elena was hanging out at home with Emerson, watching TV and having a snack.
I think I had an egg or something.
When her stomach suddenly turned.
That's weird. Eggs don't bother me.
Elena had a hunch, and the next day she took a pregnancy test. Well, actually, 3 pregnancy tests.
I think 3 positives kind of meant we were pregnant. I had like 2 different situations with each pregnancy. Like one, I was working 80 hours a week. The other one, I was at home the entire pregnancy. And one flew by and the other one like just drug on.
Would you say you'd prefer to work during a pregnancy or not work during a pregnancy?
If you have a good pregnancy and you don't have any medical issues, I would highly suggest like working as much as possible because it helps the time fly by.
In late January, Elena's daughter McKenna was born.
But yeah, I was like, wow, that's a lot of goo on the baby. Like people are like, oh, my baby's so pretty. And I was like, look at all that stuff on her.
Describe the first time you looked at her when you did it. Think she was gross.
Oh, she was so pretty. And, like, she got her mama's eyes, so she has these big old blue eyes, too. Beautiful eyes, beautiful smile.
On a normal day at Great America, Elena spends her mornings quietly getting her department ready for the day.
Making sure all the lights are on, all the interior cabinets are open, all our vehicles are unlocked.
In the quiet time before the national anthem signals the opening of the park, she interacts with coworkers and walks around, gets fresh air, exercise. But at home during quarantine with 2 kids,
I would wake up before the kids just so I could at least get some laundry started.
That routine was thrown a little out of whack.
I swear, as soon as one kid wants something, then all of a sudden the other one wants something, whether it be something to eat, something to drink, something to watch, something to do. And I'm like, ugh. It would take me like 3 days to get our laundry done. And then I like get to the end and I'm like, there's more laundry. There's always laundry.
Despite the laundry, Elena says she loved the experience of being a stay-at-home mom. In fact, it changed her view of work completely.
Just being able to spend every day with my son, I was like, wow, there is no need for me to spend as much time at work as I do because you're not going to get this time back with them.
At the end of March 2021, California's Great America began to ramp up operations and bring back essential personnel. Elena says one of their first orders of business was removing a lot of the COVID-19 precautions they had installed a year before because they were no longer required. A lot of the medications and supplies at first aid had expired during the year-long closure, and the team had a very short window to restock all of those because in May, California's Great America reopened to guests. Elena now works part-time at California's Great America, an adjustment she decided to make during the pandemic.
I was like, I'll go back part-time and go when I am needed and not have to worry about it, because I'd rather be with the kids than be at work dealing with other people's kids.
If you're planning to head to the park, Elena has some advice. Wash your hands and remember,
you should probably drink a 12-ounce bottle of water every hour. And you should be using the bathroom at least once an hour. If you're not, then you're probably dehydrated. And eat, too. That helps your body. Your body needs food to work.
Don't end up being a code, what was the?
10-5-3.
The not vertical.
A not vertical person, yes. Pretty much.
At California's Great America in Santa Clara, I'm Christopher Beal for Cross Currents.
Christopher reported that story in 2021 as part of our At Work series. You can find more stories like it at kalw.org, and we'll be dropping new episodes later this month, so stay tuned. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Judy Juanita is like a walking book of Bay Area history. The Oakland author and Laney College professor joined the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s while attending San Francisco State. Women made up two-thirds of the Black Panther Party, and Judy Juanita served as the editor of their newspaper. A few days after graduating college, she taught at San Francisco State's Black Studies Department, which was the first in the nation. Most recently, she won an American Book Award for her poetry collection, Manhattan My Ass, You're in Oakland. And now she's part of an anthology honoring the Black Arts Movement. It's called Black Fire This Time. KELW's Janae Darden spoke with Judy Juanita.
Judy, you are so Oakland. You grew up in the town. You teach at Laney. You attended Merritt College. You were a Black Panther. You were the editor at one point of the Black Panther Party newspaper.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with the Panthers?
When I got to Oakland City College, which it was called then, became Merritt College later. Huey's girlfriend at the time.
And that's Huey Newton.
Huey Newton's girlfriend at the time. We took tennis together and her locker was next to mine. So Huey always came to, she's a white girl, long hair. Huey always came to her locker saying, "Where's Margaret? Where's Margaret? Where's Margaret?" You know, and I would be like, "I don't know where she is," you know. But that's how we got to know each other. However, when I transferred to San Francisco State, it was different. The whole campus of San Francisco State was radicalized, and many students had gone down and participated in the Freedom Summers and the bus rides for voter registration down south, really put their lives at risk. And they came back from that Freedom Summer, I believe it was 67. And they radicalized the entire campus. And you could kind of like take your choice, Sexual Freedom League, Young Democratic Socialists, so forth. So at that time, then Huey and Bobby came to San Francisco State the same exact way that IBM and Clorox came recruiting. They came, they had a room. You know, they had a spiel that they delivered. They had sign-up sheets in the back. So my roommates signed up right away. I told my roommates, I said, "Listen, I know these guys from Oakland City College. They are not playing hopscotch. You know, this is not a game." So that was October 67. Then in 68, this was all on April 4th, 5th, 6th. These series of events occurred. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then little Bobby Hutton. Mm-hmm. All this took place within 3 days. There was a shootout in West Oakland between the police and the Panthers.
Yeah.
And they killed little Bobby Hutton, assassinated him. He was the first death of the party.
And he was what? 17?
He was 17.
Yeah, he was young. He was very, very young.
So then after the shootout, so many people were jailed. So many top leaders were in prison that Bobby Seale called a meeting. And we'd always, when there was something really important, we'd always have these meetings out in the open air where we couldn't be taped by the FBI. So he brings a recorder and Huey has given instructions and has basically reorganized the party at that point. So my boyfriend, Buzz, who his name is Clarence Carl Thomas Jr. and he's big ILWU labor leader, but we were boyfriend and girlfriend at that time. We're sitting there and we hear Huey say, "And I want to appoint Judy Hart, editor in chief of the paper. I know her from City College and she's a together sister," you know, something like that. And of course our eyes just popped out of our head, you know, but then I became the editor in chief, never having been an editor in chief of a paper, always having been a reporter, you know, a working journalist.
And to be the editor in chief of that paper, were you ever afraid for your life?
No. And I think it was because I was kind of naive or too young to understand the situations that I was in. Mm-hmm. You know, until that weekend of Martin Luther King and Bobby Hutton being killed, it was just, I'm going to have to tell you, it was just extraordinarily exciting. It was big fun. And all of a sudden when that happened, I realized, wow, I could be killed. But I just didn't think, you know, like most people, it's not going to happen to me, you know? So, and I, again, I was always busy because I was always either a student and an activist or a wife and then a mother and an activist. So I just, that period in my life from about 20 to 24 was the most active period in my entire life.
You know, and I think too, when you're young, you know, you have that kind of fearlessness.
Yes, you
know,
exactly.
You have that kind of fearlessness.
Exactly.
Let's talk about another project that you're involved in, Black Fire this time.
Oh, yeah, with Kim, Dr. Kim.
Yes. Yes, Dr. Kim. Shout out to Dr. Kim McMillan.
Yes.
And this is an anthology on the history and legacy of the Black arts movement. And it's huge. It's 500 pages.
Yes.
And it includes the likes of Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, and locals like yourself, Tongo Isa Martin, and Michael Warr. That, you know, and it's important because so many times Black voices are forgotten. And the people I name have been such a big contributors to the Black arts movement. What was your contribution to this book? And how did you feel being a part of this?
First of all, just very happy to be included in it. And I also included a chapter from my novel, Virgin Soul. And the chapter is actually a standalone short story. And it's been in several anthologies. And I think it's called How I First Met Leroy Jones. And I use the name Leroy Jones throughout it. And that was Amiri Baraka's name before he changed it to Amiri Baraka. So it's really all about meeting him at San Francisco State. And I love what Porfirio said.
Porfirio is our producer for Sights and Sounds.
Yes, yes. And he said that coming to San Francisco and to San Francisco State helped him become a whole new person. And that was a very similar situation for me. So I was happy to include that look at that time. I think it's very important what Kim McMillan has done with that book is made it not only a retrospective, in other words, a look back at that time, but she's also included basically what you might call are the products or the grandchildren of that time, like a Tongo Isa Martin.
That was writer Judy Juanita speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel, and you can hear more of it at KELW.org. The San Francisco Public Library is hosting a virtual reading where you can hear Judy read with other writers featured in the anthology Black Fire This Time. That's Saturday, July 16th. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we'll hear from some more Bay Area writers. We're going to showcase just how diverse the San Francisco book scene is with the work of three authors. It's another episode of New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Today, we'll hear three local writers read from their essay collections. We'll start with journalist and author Beth Weingartner. Her zine, which came out in April 2021, has one of the best titles ever, A Riff of One's Own, Gender, Queerness, and Hysteria in Glam Metal.
It includes two essays on one of my favorite subjects, 80s metal. Here's a key passage from the first essay. The emotional palette of heavy metal was so much wider than anything I'd heard before. By the time I was 16, already a prime season for turbulent emotions, I'd survived a series of horrors, a sexual assault, and the death of a close friend. My mom had been hospitalized, but in my family, we rarely acknowledged our feelings, let alone talked about them. These tough guys with their long hair and pretty faces reflected the rage, loneliness, and anguish that racked me. The guitars gave voice to wordless, nameless feelings within me. When they chimed in sorrow, my own melancholy was soothed. When they screamed and roared, the wild and furious parts of me howled back. At a time when it seemed like nobody around me could possibly understand, these musicians understood me completely.
That was Beth Weingartner reading from A Riff of One's Own. So some of us turn to screaming guitars to work out our feelings, and others need to tap into our childhood selves. Writer and activist Virgie Tovar wrote The Body Positive Journal, which came out May 1st, 2022.
It's about the extraordinary power that just a little journaling and some very cute stickers can have on how you feel about your body. There are also short essays that are sort of a mix between a pep talk and a sparkly little truffle of wisdom. Like this one from the section titled Move and Eat for Fun. Remember being a kid? You probably did all kinds of goofy, silly, weird, fun things with your body. You jumped on your bed or spent an hour trying to touch the highest branch of a tree. You dreamed of eating a sundae with 32 scoops of ice cream. You wiggled and jiggled. You ate Halloween candy like it was the last day on earth. You rolled down hills. You danced when you heard a song you loved. You ran, you laughed, you did. And there was no shame or sense of failure attached because there was no goal other than having fun. All of these fun, silly kid things are perfectly legitimate examples of healthy moving and eating.
That was Virgie Tovar reading from The Body Positive Journal. And our final essay collection is about the triumphs and disasters of dating. Jody Klein's book First Date Stories came out in September 2021.
It's a collection of true and memorable tales of debut dates that women in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s went out on. Here's an excerpt from a story called The Cringe. Adam turned to Maria. "I need to tell you something." The levity in his voice had evaporated. Maria braced herself. "What? Just tell me. Whatever it is, it's fine," she replied, with a mix of warmth and exasperation in her voice. "This is not the first time we've met. We've been out on a date before. Maybe you remember? We had lunch at a French restaurant downtown 14 years ago." Maria stared at him in disbelief. She scoured her memory, desperately waiting, hoping for a recollection of their prior date to emerge. Even a faint reminiscence would provide her with needed clues. She was sure her synapses were firing, but no flashback appeared. Her memory was a wasteland. Her muscles tensed up. A cringe swept through her body.
That was Jody Klein reading from First Date Stories.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can hear more at klw.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Monica Gomez, Hanisha Harjani, Gabe Graben, James Rollins, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.